You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line are Greg Buccioroni and Victor Thorne. Guys, thanks for joining us today.
It's good to be here, Dave.
Good morning, Dave.
Now, Victor, you know a lot more about Greg than most people do, so why don't you give an introduction for Greg for the listeners?
Yeah, Greg Buccioroni's come to prominence, and he's, I believe right now, one of the most important figures in the whole Jerry Sandusky sex scandal, because when so many other individuals at the second mile, at Penn State, in the media, even politicians, remain silent for years and years, maybe even over a decade, one person stepped forward, Greg Buccioroni, who was a victim of this abuse. And he said, I'm not going to stay silent any longer. I'm going to speak up. And I've interviewed Greg before. I spoke with him last night. And yesterday he told me, he says, I'm not going to take no for an answer anymore. So what makes Greg's story so compelling and so important is that in our society today, especially with this awful Jerry Sandusky sex scandal, when so many people brushed it under the rug or turned the other way, finally we have somebody who's standing up and saying, we're going to point a finger at these people that did this and we're going to expose them. And that's why I have so much respect for what Greg's doing. So I want to bring Greg in right now and let him tell his story. And Greg, just tell us a little bit about who you are and how you came into this situation.
Sure. Well, who I am now is I work as a full-time school police officer in the Philadelphia school system, and I've been a somewhat 20-year veteran as a volunteer with the city as a crime victims advocate. But it wasn't always happy days. Back in the 70s, going into the early 80s, I was one of many poster childs for juvenile delinquency in the city. What I meant by poster child and juvenile delinquency was primarily kids starting out, best of intentions, but before you know it, you're shoplifting, you're truant from school, you're sneaking on the subways, you're throwing rocks at buses, you're spray painting. Before you know it, you're coming home at midnight. Now, keep in mind, I'm probably about 9 or 10 years old. And how I was able to get away with that so much is my mom and dad, back in the 70s, were going through a divorce. And my mom had to work two jobs. My older sister, she was, I guess, 18. She was dating boys. She was babysitting us, but she wasn't keeping a good eye on us. And we were able to run the streets. And when you run the streets, you wind up getting involved with other criminal-type juveniles. One thing leads to another. Before you know it, I'm working for mobsters, doing small errands for them.
That led you then to meeting with a man named Edward Savitz, who was notorious in the Philadelphia area as being not only tied to politicians and judges and people in City Hall, but also with mobsters. And this is what really brings you into the whole orbit of this second mile. When I interviewed you originally a few weeks ago, you spoke about these trips from Philadelphia to second mile fundraisers in Pennsylvania. And you said that the minute you got there, you could tell it was a breeding ground, that they were passing pictures of naked kids around. Tell us how you were brought up here in the environment and the atmosphere that you witnessed.
Well, getting back to how I connected to Ed Savitz, because that directly leads to Sandusky. Back in 76, juvenile-related crime in Philadelphia was at all-time high. Ed Rendell at the time, who was good friends with Ed Savitz, they went to school together, University of Penn, and they belonged to the same alumni and social circuits in Philadelphia. And what happened was, Rendell was running in 1976 for Philadelphia District Attorney. He was the new guy on the block, and he reached out to his buddy Ed Savitz, who was a multimillionaire philanthropist. And they were at these political campaign fundraisers. Well, vote for me, I'm running for DA. And some of the questions came up, what are you going to do about juvenile-related crime in Philadelphia? It's at all-time high. And that's when Ed Rendell introduced Ed Savitz, who was introduced as a youth advocate and a philanthropist. I didn't know what a philanthropist was, but apparently meant the guy's doing something good. And that he was running a youth program and promoting a program that was newly developed in the state college area called Second Mile. And they were promoting this thing. Well, this is a program that's going on. We're going to do it, and we're going to work to inner-city at-risk kids by the time the program's up and going 100% to somewhere in central western Pennsylvania, and the kid's going to be taken out of the city environment and have a better life experience there. And that was as an alternative to arresting kids and throwing them in juvenile detention centers or dysfunctional houses where kids stay at. I think they call foster parents and stuff like that. Instead of taking kids there, they were promoting the evolving of second Dr. Mull. So I was introduced to him. I signed up. Ed Savage became my youth advocate. That was in 76. Then we're going into 77. And by 76, going into 77, there was a feeling out process with Savage. He was picking and choosing certain kids. I tell people I'm a bald-headed old guy now, but back then I was this young Vinnie Barbarino from Welcome Back, Carter-looking kid. Good-looking kid. And Savage, he was very fond of me, and he took me under his wing and then slowly started to groom me. It started out little things like, you know, let's go to a pool, let's go here. If you had sex with some of the females that you got hanging with, can I watch? And then one thing led to another, and before you know it, you're caught up in the middle of a child pedophile ring.
So eventually, like by 79 and 80 then, Savitz is bringing you up to State College, the State College area, Second Mile fundraisers. And you said it felt like this breeding ground that kids were exchanged and swapped like baseball cards, that you felt dirty and cheap, like a little go-go dancer at a bachelor party. So once you get up there, this is really important, is to describe to people so they can understand what this atmosphere was like among these pedophiles. And of course, all of them weren't pedophiles, but the ones that were involved in this, tell us about the atmosphere and how these people operated.
From 77 to 79, as relayed to me from Savage, that Sandusky already had nude photos of me. And he was very interested for me to come up there so we can go out socially and interact with him in a friendly way. Friendly way meaning pedophiles type stuff. But I didn't know who Sandusky was. He referred to Sandusky as the coach from Dr. Mull, meaning Savage. Back then, I was running the streets. I was between running Atlantic City, New York City. There was no cell phone, so it was hard to get a hold of me on a consistent basis, unlike today. So what happened was, in 79, I was starting to get in more trouble. Juvenile authorities in Philadelphia were getting ready to consider placing me into a juvenile detention center. So I finally said, well, I don't want to be in jail. And then it was told to me, well, you're going to go here. It's going to keep you out of trouble and take you away from Philadelphia. But at the same time, I'm going to be friendly with Sandusky and these other guys that are up in that State College area. So nonetheless, I'm in Blackwood, New Jersey, 1979. It's like summertime. And Savage says he's coming to pick me up to take me to State College. And that was going to be a two-part thing. One was to go up there and get information on my parents regarding enrollment applications. The second part was to obviously engage in sex with Jerry Sandusky, who I did not know, in return for $200. So it gave the appearance to my parents that, well, you know what, he's going to take them up there and they're going to be there. My stepfather at the time was a big Penn State fan, and he always watched the football game, so he's all excited. Maybe this will save this kid. And quite frankly, I thought, well, maybe this is a turning point in my life. I wasn't sure. I was kind of in a gray area in the adolescent state of mind. So picks me up, drives me over on the way there. He's telling me and this other kid, I want you guys on your best behavior, this and that. He's talking about that. Joe Paterno comes in the room. You guys got to be on your best P's and Q's and your best behavior. And I didn't know who any of these guys are. The only thing I knew was the coach from Second Mile. Now, how I knew him was by Savage constantly talking about him in Second Mile via conversations in Philadelphia of me going there to visit and meet this guy. So eventually I get up there, and I don't know who's who. I know some guys. This is a program. Looks like important people there, but I'm being brought there, and I'm kind of figuring out who's got my best interest, who doesn't, and I'm kind of feeling out body language and the general vibe. So eventually Savage introduced me to Sandusky, and when I see him, it's not what I expected at all. I'm looking for some little weaselly, degenerate-looking guy who kind of looks like a pervert. But when I meet Sandusky initially, I don't think that. I'm looking at him, I'm reading his body language, but nothing's coming back as a pedophile. Nothing's coming back as a sexual deviant. It kind of reminded me of this guy that was a stand-up guy.
You described him as he's like being treated like a movie star there.
There was a lot of people shaking his hand when I meet him. He's taking pictures with people. He's talking. I don't know who these people are, but they look important. And at this time, I'm just some poor kid from Philadelphia. So I'm up there and I'm just sitting there and I get introduced to this guy. And I'm thinking he must be important because a lot of people want to meet him and talk to him and shake his hand. So I don't know who he is, but I'm looking at him. I'm thinking this guy doesn't even look, because I've been hearing about this guy. Savage had talked about him often, but I'm expecting someone else. And then when I get there, I see this guy. He looks like a legitimate guy. Then at some point, we go to a side area of this event, and we talk a little bit more. They talk about an after party, and Sandusky's looking at nude photos of me to the side discreetly with Savage and these other guys, and there was a few other kids, and they're looking like baseball cards. Then they said, well, we're going to go to this after party. But the after party never happens because the social event is going over the time frame. And Savitz is one of those guys, if you say 12 o'clock, 12 o'clock means 12 o'clock. It doesn't mean 12:15 or 12:40. So he's on the time frame, and he wanted to get back. So Zandusky says, well, I'll leave him here, and maybe we could get someone to take him home tomorrow. And then I remember Savitz and Zandusky debating about that. And then Savitz pulls me aside and says, look, I'm not leaving here with these sickos. And then I'm thinking, because I'm already well into the molestation and being victimized by Savitz and others already associated with Savitz. And I'm thinking, this guy's just calling this one a sicko, and he's a sicko himself. So I kind of thought that was odd. But he wasn't going to leave me there. And then he says, either you get in the car or you fucking walk him back to Philadelphia. I don't know where I'm at. There's nothing but farms and pig stuff out there. I don't know anything. So, of course, I'm going to get in the car. And then what he did is there was another guy, the heavyset guy. And the guy says, well, I'll drive back to Philadelphia. What he wanted to do is, since Zandusky was unavailable at that time frame to do what I was brought up there to do from the first place, was engage in sexual behavior with Zandusky. Since he was unavailable, I referred to him mentally in my brain. And later on, with the kid who was with me, is a fat slob. He was a heavyset guy, business type man, that followed us back to Philadelphia. And then Savitz dropped us off at a local Philadelphia Center City motel. And then he engaged in sexual acts with me.
And this is a fundraiser, so these are people with money that are obviously giving donations to the Second Mile. That your impression was they were doctors, lawyers, businessmen, politicians, things like that. So that's the vibe you got from the people in attendance that day?
Well, there's two vibes I got. Initially, I got the initial walking in, and everyone looks to be official, and everything's on the up and up. And for the most part, it was. But then what happened is, as the event's going on, especially as it's starting to wind down, you're sitting over here, then Savitz will come up, and, yo, this is the kid I've been talking to you about. Hint, hint, wink, wink. This secret handshake grip and how they kind of like massage your back. Well, his main purpose was, of course, to give the appearance to my parents that he was getting me enrollment application and to take me out on the day event. But the main thing was to introduce me to his friend. And apparently that Savitz had been bragging about me to his friends since 77 and that he shared new photos. And even at that event, discreetly amongst themselves, they were looking at new photos. It did not just me, but other kids. So what happens is you go there and everyone looks legit and everyone looks like the typical Brady Bunch dad. But then as you get to the side a little bit, then their behavior changes. And this is how you know who's got your best interest and who doesn't. And what I mean by behavior is it goes almost like I'm a girl at a bar and a guy wants to buy me a drink. And then it goes from being straightforward, kind of bass in his voice, to bass drops, to body language change. It becomes more touchy-touchy. They didn't touch my private parts, but they're like rubbing on my knee, like just touching my hand, kind of like just fixing my hair, massaging my back, and then the body language. And then that gets into, oh, well, you know, I'm going to have a party. I would love you to come over there. And he said, do you have swimming shorts? They always joked about that because a lot of these parties involve pools. And the kids that they were filling out and trying to groom, see how far these kids would go, bring some of your girlfriends. The girlfriends is because a lot of these guys don't want to be construed as gay. But if you have girls there and the girls are skinny dipping and you're skinny dipping, it's the icebreaker. And then they would say, well, bring your shorts. Not that you'll need it. And they always joked about stuff like that. Then you got to realize the ones that didn't have your best interest, the ones that you were like the go-go girl at a bachelor's party. Every bachelor party, you have guys that don't really engage the go-go girls. They're just there for their buddy. Then the other ones that are the dogs. And they come there and they're like a dog in heat. Well, that's how some of these people were. And here's the odd thing. Even if I didn't see or know who Paterno was, if it was mentioned that he was in the area, I felt safe because we never knew if we were going to get violently raped. But some of these guys were big and we're still little kids. So when they take us to these spots and say, well, the guy's just going to engage in all sex or masturbate or he's going to whatever they're going to do. And then Paterno would be around or was feared to be around. These guys backed away from us. The only feeling I can give to you is kind of like going to an ATM machine in a questionable neighborhood and you're going to use that ATM and you look from side to side and a police car stops or a police officer walks behind you to wait to use the ATM. Behind you and the police, he's in uniform, the police radio is going off. You get that feeling of safety and security that you're going to be okay while using this because there's a cop in the area. But that's how me and a lot of kids felt when Paterno was somewhere in the area. So when I hear them dumping on Paterno, I'm thinking, oh, this is wrong. Because they were concerned that one of our kids would act out and that Paterno would find out. Even though we didn't know who Paterno was, they knew who Paterno was. So they kept telling us, best behavior, teasing shoes, don't do this. Only engage my friends, don't drink, don't do this, don't go crazy. Because some of these events, kids would argue there'd be alcohol involved. And then the kid obviously is already problematic. at the event, and this would be at some of these social events, kids would be like, man, you're going to give me some money? And they would start arguing. This is the pedophile versus the child victim. And they'd start arguing, and next thing you know, the one guy's calling the other one a faggot and give me some money. I'm going to tell him he's sucking my dick. You can't have that at these events. When we were going to the second mile where supporting people were going to be, they didn't want any of that type of behavior. So when Paterno and them was mentioned, even though I didn't see him, it was mentioned he was in the area, we had to be best behaved, and they didn't want any of that. Like when we went to other places where Paterno wasn't mentioned they was going to be at, they never groomed or warned us or anything. But when we got to that State College area, or it was a football game in Philadelphia or something where it was rumored that Paterno was going to be, we were groomed heavily. So that's what gave us the feeling that Paterno was this person who wasn't part of this. They didn't want him to know about it. And when we came in the room, they backed away from us. Once the behavior came in and you've seen the second part of this pedophiles, that you see the first part when you meet them and then how they slowly become the sexual deviant and they're trying to touch you and proposition you. Then when Paterno was said to be in the area, they stayed away from us. He was like our unofficial security blanket, even though we didn't even know what Paterno looked like. So when I seen him blaming that, I said, man, this guy's being made the fall guy. They never did nothing about this in the 80s. They never did nothing in the 90s when they had Savage. And they had direct information, meaning photos, pictures, and detailed book information when they locked up Savage in 92. They had direct ties and links to Second Mile and Sandusky.
There's a local radio talk show host here on two different occasions raised a great question. How do these pedophiles go about doing this? In other words, he says, if somebody wants to go and buy a bag of weed or whatever, you'd know about where to go, and you go up to someone and it's like, hey, you got any smoke? But he says, how do these people, because it's so foreign to 99.999% of everybody, so how does even somebody break the ice, or how does someone get involved in this activity to even do it? That's what he's been asking, and it's a great question because I don't know the answer either.
Well, I can't speak on behalf of Sandusky and how he did it. I know how Savage and people in the Philadelphia, New York City area did it. They didn't know each other. Philadelphia had, and just like New York City and Times Square, had peep shows, these adult movie theaters all over the place. Triple X, burlesque shows, X-rated movies, peep shows, bookstores. You could get anything there. And that was the magnet for societies. It was in certain what they called the porn districts. New York City had it up in Times Square. Philadelphia had it in Center City. And that's where you had a certain block radius, so many blocks that was consumed with X-rated bookstores, very criminal-elemented bars, and businesses to attract undesirables within a congested area. They used to call it the porn district or the red light districts. I don't know how Savage met Sandusky, he never told me. But how they interacted, if they didn't know each other in Philadelphia, meaning other pedophiles that was associated with this pedophile ring that was associated with Sandusky and Second Mile. How many of them met or how they get to interact, they go to these peep shows. Now they don't know each other. They walk in, but as they're peeping back and forth, and then adolescent boys who are allowed to go in there. It's against the law, but nobody's saying nothing. And it generates business for these mobsters who are running. So we're back and forth, and they say, hey, you want to come in and watch a movie with me? That's where the prostitution goes. And then by seeing it enough times, interacting and seeing this one and that one, and just by being in the peep show at the same time as this guy, you get to see people all the time. And then before you know it, they're conversating. And then one thing leads to another, and it goes from two separate individual pedophiles to now a group of pedophiles that know each other. And then, of course, they change telephone or communication, whether it was a fax or a phone number or a mailing address, and now they're starting to build up a small network. And then before you know it, you go from a handful of them to a whole bunch of them.
I wonder how these upper-level people that would be at the Second Mile or other functions in the tri-state area or all across the country, the more wealthy individuals, do you have any idea how these people, because people that are hanging out at peep shows and in the porn district aren't going to be the wealthy to-do individuals making large donations to the Second Mile or any other organization. So how do the wealthy people get into it that Savitz would know?
Savage was pretty bold and flamboyant. He believed that he was above the law in Philadelphia and New York. You're right. How did these other business guys, how did they do it without putting themselves at a liability? What happens is, I guess, through a process of social gatherings and general conversations, it's kind of like, I tell you this, you ever been at a football game, high school football game, and you're with a couple guys and you're sitting there and they see some girl, she's borderline legal. And the guy says, oh, man, I'd like to have her as a babysitter, and I'd be hitting the babysitter, and they all go, ha, 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 ha. Even though you don't engage with you, listening to it, to social gatherings, sporting events, this, that, and maybe someone makes a comment. And it's kind of like one of those hypothetical comments, like a metaphor.
So it's a feeling out process.
It's a filling out process. I don't know if you've ever been maybe at a shopping center or something, and where there's young borderline girls, and some guys may make some comments, some older guys like Al Bundy types, they make a comment, oh man, if I wasn't going to jail, I'd be all over that. Well, that's how stuff like that goes at social events. And then one thing leads to another, and before you know it, they're communicating and maybe they're going to a bar or a barbecue, and then things slowly develop. It's like a friendship.
Yeah.
I don't know how many times where you met someone and you don't know this person, then you start dialoguing a little bit, and before you know it, you become friends. Well, they become friends.
He must have taken you to other functions other than just the second mile where these individuals were preying on boys also, didn't he?
Second mile was a very tiny part of my victimization. What I mean victimization is people are like, well, you said he didn't touch him. Nah, he didn't touch me. He had nude photos of me. He solicited Savage to pick me up in New Jersey, took me across state lines to Penn State or State College area. He was going to give me $200 to do some kind of sexual perversion act. Even though he didn't do it, I'm still a victim because those are all crimes and he had targeted me and exploited me with alcohol, the promise of drugs or this or that, and cash in return for a sexual favor. And at the time, I think when that occurred, I think I was 79. I think I was 13 years old or 14 years old. So roughly I'm a kid. I'm not no 17-year-old kid. I'm a young, becoming an adolescent, young teenager. Yeah, I went to all the social events. A lot of times we met pedophiles at political fundraisers. The social gatherings, they had the arts and culture. That was another place we met a lot of them, where we'd sit down and there would be some kind of play or this and that, and they would interact. And not everybody was a pedophile. A lot of people, hey, hi, and goodbye, and pretty much they didn't engage in conversation or behavior that would be associated with a pedophile. But there was those. How you knew those were those is Savage would always walk up and introduce me to the guy and say, this is the kid I've been talking about. Oh, that's the kid in the picture? Because sometimes the pictures didn't include your face.
Mm-hmm.
They included just from your waist down, or you're in a position where it's hard to really take a good look at the face because maybe you're bent over or something. A lot of these guys were business guys and they were married or they were living a double life. Back in the 70s, you didn't have the technology you have today. You didn't have internet, cell phones. So when you had 8mm video film and you had regular pictures, you had to have that stuff developed. So it's through these two social networks that all appeared to be the arts and culture, the opera, the art houses, the plays. Savage was all into that, and all his friends were into that. You just couldn't go to mom-and-pop film developer because they would see what you're developing, and they may contact the authorities. And if you're a business person with a lot to lose because you have this legitimate reputation in the community, you can't go to the neighborhood store and say, hey, can you develop this film for me or these pictures? Because they're going to see. So what you had to do is you had to go to an illegitimate place. And during the 70s and early 80s, that illegitimate place was a company in Philadelphia, New York, called Brighton Enterprises, which acted as a front for the Gambino crime family. Either we were at an event and they would give it to them, but for the most part, they used the U.S. mail. And they would send it to Savage. Savage would pick it up at 30th Street Post Office in Philadelphia, which at that time, it was the major postal hub in the city. And then from there, we would go into the porn district section of the city, illegal porn in general, because there was also bestiality. You had rape porn and even had porn where people were being raped and murdered. It looked like in third world countries. And of course, the traditional child porn. You could go there, get your film developed. Savage, I introduced him to these mobsters. A lot of them, they knew him, but they didn't know him. But as I knew them and he knew that I knew him, he became comfortable. And then before you know it, many times he wouldn't even use me. He would just go back and forth.